This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
Tech companies like Meta, Apple, Signal, and NordVPN say the Canadian bill would force them to weaken their privacy protections.
Part two of the bill would potentially force us to break encryption and to install government-directed hardware or software on our encrypted networks that would inevitably then also become a target for hostile actors.
Last week, the chairs of two American congressional committees even wrote to Canada's public safety minister, saying Bill C-22 would create significant cross-border risks to the security and data privacy of Americans.
Last month, this podcast featured a roundtable on Bill C-22, in which I spoke with David Fraser and Robert Diab about the primary concerns with the Lawful Access Bill. Since that time, it's fair to say that the government's plans for lawful access have really just gone off the rails. Signal has warned that it would pull out of the Canadian market rather than comply with the bill. Windscribe, the Toronto-headquartered VPN provider, has said it would relocate its headquarters out of Canada. NordVPN has warned it would consider following suit. ProtonVPN has said it can't comply with the law. Meanwhile, the big players have spoken out as well. Apple and Meta have both raised public concerns about the bill's effect on encryption and cybersecurity. The Canadian Chamber of Commerce, the Cybersecurity Advisors Network, civil liberties groups, and a long line of legal and security experts have all called for changes. And as you just heard in the opening clip, the chairs of the U.S. House Judiciary and Foreign Affairs Committees have written to Public Safety Minister Gary Anansangri, warning that the bill threatens U.S. national security and the integrity of cross-border data flows. Now, I think much of the momentum against the bill started once the Standing Committee on Public Safety and National Security began to conduct its hearings into the legislation, providing an opportunity for critics to discuss their concerns. Those hearings will continue this week, with both Google and Apple scheduled to appear. For this episode of the Law Bites podcast, I wanted to take you into the hearing room for my appearance on Bill C-22. The appearance was a repeat of the podcast, as I appeared alongside Fraser and Diab. This episode will feature my opening statement and exchanges with MPs from all parties on a wide range of issues. I start with my five-minute opening.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for the invitation. My name, as you heard, is Michael Geist. I'm a law professor at the University of Ottawa, where I hold the Canada Research Chair in Internet and E-commerce Law. I appear in a personal capacity representing only my own views. In preparation for today's hearing, I looked back at the history of my engagement with lawful access policy. I found that I wrote my first op-ed on the issue more than 20 years ago and first began appearing before committees on various bills a few years after that. As I'm sure you know, lawful access has been the subject of legislative debate in Canada for decades, under both Liberal and Conservative governments. The technologies change, the governments may change, but the challenge has always been the same: to give law enforcement and security agencies the tools they need to address serious crime, while respecting Canadians' privacy rights and the constitutional framework the Supreme Court has built around privacy in decisions such as Spencer and Bykovitz. Bill C-2 is what happens when the bill is not well struck. The balance is not well struck, as its warrantless information demand power envisioned compelling disclosure of subscriber information of any provider of a service in Canada without court oversight. The decision to drop that power was the right one, and replacing it with a confirmation of service demand is a meaningful change. Bill C-22 nevertheless contains some serious problems, and I'll focus on three. They're going to echo what we just heard from Professor Diab. The first I'm going to focus on is the mandatory metadata retention regime, which would require providers to retain metadata for up to a year on every subscriber, regardless of suspicion. On a mobile network, that data includes cell phones, cell towers, each phone connects to and when, retained at scale. The aggregate amounts to a comprehensive surveillance map of virtually every Canadian, where and when they go, and who they interact with. This is the kind of bulk data retention regime that the European Union Court of Justice struck down in the Digital Rights Ireland case. and in the Telesavarge case, extended to mandated private sector retention of traffic and location data. Germany's Federal Constitutional Court has reached similar conclusions, yet the charter statement on Bill C-22 remarkably fails to address the regime despite the obvious charter implications. The committee is being asked to entrench a surveillance architecture and accept the security risks that come with it. The obvious approach is to remove this entirely, as it is disproportionate and, I believe, likely to be struck down in its current form by the Supreme Court. Alternatively, perhaps a 30-day cap on metadata retention would suffice in terms of meeting the immediate investigative needs while allowing for a court order if a longer period is required. The second concern involves systemic vulnerability safeguards in the technical capability provisions. Sections 5 and 7 of the SAAIA, that's Part 2, say providers are not required to comply with an order if doing so would create a systemic vulnerability. But Sections 12 and 13 make compliance unconditional and provide that orders prevail over inconsistent regulations. That leaves a safeguard that exists in name only, largely cloaked in secrecy, with the burden of invoking it falling on the providers. The consequence is a backdoor capability mandate that could weaken encryption, place user data at risk, and lead companies to remove privacy-enhancing services from Canada. This needs a fix that should include amending Section 12 to make compliance subject to the provisions of Sections 5 and 7. Further, the definition of systemic vulnerability should be expanded by the statute, clarifying that there will be no requirement to weaken or break encryption or introduce any security weakness. The third concern is the production order threshold for subscriber information. Bill C-22 sets the standard at reasonable grounds to suspect rather than the current reasonable grounds to believe. The Spencer and Bykovitz decisions establish a high informational privacy interest in subscriber data. Yet the charter statement nevertheless asserts that subscriber information sought does not by itself constitute particularly sensitive information. I think that sentence is difficult to reconcile, both with Supreme Court jurisprudence and the technical reality of what subscriber information may reveal. Setting the bar lower invites further charter litigation, placing the provision on shaky legal ground. Now, none of the changes that I've discussed here would be incompatible with effective law enforcement tools. Rather, they're about ensuring a framework that can withstand charter scrutiny, respect Canadians' privacy rights, avoid creating a surveillance infrastructure, and sustain public interest and confidence. I look forward to your questions.
Committee Vice Chair and Chair for the day, Conservative MP Frank Caputo, asked about the shift from reasonable grounds to believe to reasonable grounds to suspect for the purposes of obtaining subscriber information.
I would like to ask the two professors in person on the reasonable grounds to suspect versus reasonable grounds to believe. It's been a while since I dealt with reasonable grounds to suspect, but my recollection of reasonable grounds to believe is that there has to be a subjective belief, as in you have to personally believe an offense has been committed, and that belief must be objectively reasonable. That's my recollection. In other words, a reasonable person would say, yeah, you had a reasonable belief. Below balance of probabilities, so not ultra high, less than 50%, but above the suspect, which is more than a hunch, but less than that. What would you say to the proposition that this is asking for very narrow data, so therefore we don't have to worry as much that this could be saved under Section 1. Would you agree with that, Professor Geist?
No, I wouldn't. And I wouldn't in two respects. First, the consistent claim that this data is of low privacy value, I think, is simply inaccurate. We just heard from Professor Diab examples. We could, and perhaps over the course of the next little bit, we'll have a chance to walk through some of those kinds of examples. But it seems to me, even the question that came up towards the very end of your last panel, which asked whether or not someone might know that you asked Siri something, the question isn't the content. The fact that you raised it and engaged with people, the fact that members of the public engage with you, And that a record would exist of who you communicate with, and there might be orders to have that kind of thing disclosed, raises, from my perspective, significant issues. This is creating, this may have significant privacy import, and so lowering the standard for this information, when there is scant evidence that the higher standard that we've had in place for many years now has posed a problem, seems to me unwarranted.
Liberal MP Anthony Housefather dove into the issue that has been top of mind for many of the large tech companies, focusing on the cybersecurity implications and, in particular, questions around what systemic vulnerability means and the prospect for potential challenges by those companies.
I think that we have a general tension in this law, as you've rightly pointed out, between the goal to be as safe as possible and the goal to respect privacy rights. And we have to find that middle where most people are comfortable. I don't think we'll ever find a situation where everybody is going to agree as to the details of the bill, but I think we have to try to find that reasonable point. I think we start from a premise where the bill is laudable in the sense that certainly it deals with some of the flaws in C2. The bill is something that is really needed in terms of law enforcement having access to information that, you know, technologically isn't dealt with under current law. But as everybody here said, there's concerns that you've expressed. I think one of the things, though, that I've noted is a real discomfort with the idea of regulations. I would point out, like, there's a suspicion as to what's going to be in the regulations, and then we're hearing hypotheticals of what might be in the regulations or how orders might be used. And some people will believe more in trusting the government and saying that they're going to act reasonably, and will say the charter still applies, and you know there's still judicial oversight over it, and other people will say no, I distrust what, you know, because I'm not going to trust it unless it's written in front of me in the bill. So I get all that. I want to deal with one issue that I also have expressed some concerns about, which is the interplay between systemic vulnerabilities and the orders, because the way I also read the bill is that there's an exemption to the company having to do it if it creates a systemic vulnerability, and I understand we might need to look at the definition of systemic vulnerability, but then in an order, the company is obliged to carry out the order. Mr. Geist, you had talked about that issue. Could you just express again the way you would amend the bill to deal with that issue?
Thanks for the question. And I guess I would highlight a couple of things. I think first, it is essential that we get greater specificity around this issue with a more clarity around what that definition sounds like. I think that the concern that many have expressed about what could this mean and the implications, this is so serious in terms of what it means for our cybersecurity and for people's privacy that I think we owe it to everyone to ensure that it becomes clearer. And respectfully, I think there is good reason for people to listen to the debate and think that, in fact, some of those concerns are warranted. You know, I've heard, for example, during the House debate, the Secretary of State for Combating Crime talk about this being a first step. And I walked into the hearing just before with the police officers talking about wanting metadata for 2 or 3 years. Is that the next step? Beginning to expand this into multiple years. I don't know, but I know that there are real concerns. So we need, in answer to your question, we need far more specificity around the definition to make very clear that this is not touching encryption. This is not, there will be no orders that will create systemic weaknesses. That's a clear starting point.
So basically, though, saying that sections, you know, 5 and 7 are subject to section 10. And I understand also adjusting the definition of systemic vulnerability.
Yes, and that was my other element. There was two. It was the definition, and it was this inconsistency that we've got in the bill that talks about, on the one hand, the ability to raise concerns, but on the other hand, language that suggests you have no real ability to challenge or at least avoid an order.
Bloc MP Claude de Belfoy asked me about the metadata issue, seeking comparison with other jurisdictions to better understand how Canada compares to its allies.
Mr. Geist, you said that keeping metadata for a year is too long, that 30 days could be reasonable, and if there are reasons to believe that there is criminality to get a mandate and extend that period. That's what I understood. Is that correct? Is that what you recommended?
What I was suggesting, in a sense, what I was trying to put forward is, you know, there is always the ability for law enforcement, if it needs this information as part of a ongoing lengthy investigation, to seek the necessary order to have it preserved. The issue that law enforcement, I think, in this context is identified is what happens. You don't know what you don't know in some circumstances, so you don't know that you might need it. And so there is this desire to build this giant haystack of information because maybe you need the needle at one point in time. It seems to me that, of course, that haystack is comprised of people who have done no wrong, they're suspicionless, and it raises for them real privacy-related concerns. So is there some kind of mechanism that we can find in the spirit of trying to address law enforcement's concerns that will allow, on a rolling basis, some of this information to be retained, but quickly discarded after an appropriate period of time? So I heard in the last panel, I think one of the members of the law enforcement was asked for a use case and talked about a missing person. Wouldn't it be good to be able to get that information? Respectfully, you don't need to retain everybody's metadata for a year for someone who's gone missing. You know, I would think, frankly, 30 days is more than enough to realize the person's missing. And then if there is a need to try to obtain other metadata, go for it. You can get the order to get it.
Thank you for that answer. I think that's very clear. We all care about Bill C-22, and we've all committed to working together and to improve it. So if you would propose an amendment, a very specific amendment or improvement, we would welcome anything from you, especially if you want to have it translated into both official languages. Next question. I learned, and unless I misunderstood, that in the U.S., rather in Europe, the retention of metadata is done in cases of serious crime, and Europe is much more careful about protecting privacy rights. And that in the U.S., it's not clear that they keep metadata for a very long time either. Do you feel that with C-22, Canada would be more intrusive into the private lives of Canadians compared to Europe and the U.S.?
I mean, thank you for the question. You know, Europe has had now a whole series of cases, both at the European level and at the national level amongst a number of member states, that have found some of the initiatives around mandatory metadata retention to be disproportionate. And so you get these cases and countries begin to respond. And so it is a bit of a mix in terms of length and also under what circumstances, for what particular instances one might be able to retain that information. But it's very clear that European courts are uncomfortable with what I would characterize now as a Bill C-22 style metadata approach of retaining everything for a year. And as you heard in the last panel, in the United States, we don't see that retention at all. So I think it makes us clearly out of step with some of those countries, but even perhaps more importantly, for the purposes of creating legislation that will sustain a potential challenge, I think it's out of step with where the charter is.
So what I understand, Mr. Geist, is that police chiefs and the authorities have told us that they want to be aligned with the Five Eyes. But what I'm hearing from you is that the metadata retention regime would be broader here than amongst our Five Eyes allies and European countries. Is that what you're saying?
You can find examples that where it's consistent or otherwise, but you know, to the extent to which we heard just before the talk about a lot of North-South related issues with respect to crime. In the United States, we don't see these metadata requirements. In many European countries, we don't either. And so Canada would certainly be open to creating a system either without this at all, or if they did for a very short period of time, working in conjunction with the ability to get quick freeze orders to ensure that you could retain it for longer periods. And I see little reason to think that that would not be viewed as doing our part within as compared to our allies.
Conservative MP Rhonda Kirkland focused on the government's charter statement and the surprising omission of metadata from its analysis.
Dr. Geist, in your May 2026 article, Willful Blindness, and there's a question mark on that, you argued that the charter statement, which the Department of Justice requires the Minister of Justice to prepare, largely ignored some of Bill C-22's most constitutionally vulnerable provisions. In your view, why do you think the government avoided meaningfully addressing the sections of the bill that are most likely to raise serious charter and privacy concerns?
Well, thanks for the question. I mean, I don't have a good answer for why they did it or why they didn't address those issues. But I will say that I think it raises real concerns. If the reason is they don't believe that issues, let's say, around mandatory metadata retention raise charter issues and so felt there was no need to include it, I think both that is inaccurate with respect as a matter of law, but I also think it suggests, as we've been saying, that this legislation is going to be challenged quickly, and I think that there is a real risk that provisions like that get struck down.
Liberal MP Samir Zubairi asked me a pair of questions, focusing first on the impact that the bill might have on racialized communities, and then shifting to questions about the approach that is used in other jurisdictions with respect to metadata, namely a quick freeze of the data in appropriate circumstances.
We know that in policing that there have been disproportionate impacts with respect to racialized communities, Indigenous people, and different social movements. Do you have any concerns around impacts being different for specific communities within Canada as it applies to this legislation?
Well, I mean, I could start and perhaps others
please
can proceed. I have concerns, you know, the concerns that we've expressed, you know, I think we'll do run the risk of undermining the trust. I referenced that towards the end of my remarks, undermining the trust between the public, their providers, and frankly, law enforcement itself. So when you talk about communities where some of that trust may have been even now strained, the notion that we are creating frameworks that lessen the safeguards that exist in terms of the standard to be able to obtain information and even the base knowledge that as people become more aware of the implications of some of these provisions, that, you know, who they speak with, like from on their devices, where they go, who they and how they engage, all of that information being collected and retained for a year, I don't think that increases the level of trust that people have, both with their providers, knowing that their providers have this information, and then layering on top of that the fact that the providers have been compelled to collect that information and then sort of and then enveloped with secrecy around what might take place with some of that kind of data. I think all of this undermines the trust that exists between the public and the various kinds of authorities that we want to, I think, enhance the level of trust with.
Right, and you were talking earlier about, or at some point you've spoken about targeted quick freezes instead of the current approach. Do you have any commentary you want to expand upon that concept a bit?
Sure. So, I mean, the basic notion between a quick freeze, which is by and large what takes place today, is we should probably just back up to note that there is no commercially viable reason for providers to retain metadata for long periods of time. There are risks. We've talked about those risks. Create that big haystack, so to speak, and you create a ripe target for hackers or for others who might seek to gain access to it. It's a treasure trove, potentially, of information. But beyond that, it's expensive, which may render some providers less competitive, thereby increasing prices that Canadians face for their communication services. And so, by and large, they don't do it. And what they do, though, is create a scenario whereby they will respond to orders requiring them to retain this information while an investigation is ongoing. And so what I had suggested was, can't we find a way of marrying that system that does allow for, on that ongoing basis, to retain that data with a system that, for a very short period of time, if needed, allows for that retention that then gets quickly flushed so that you can have, in those very small minority of situations where you need that metadata retained for a long period of time, it's retained. But it's only retained where you've got an active investigation, not against all Canadians.
So in the 30 seconds that's left, do other European and Five Eyes have an approach of what you're describing?
The quick freeze is the common approach that we find in jurisdictions that don't have mandatory metadata. So it's not as if law enforcement can't get metadata in other places. They can, but with appropriate oversight, using sort of that kind of quick freeze model.
Bloc MP de Bellefeuille had another opportunity for questions, focusing once again on the definition of electronic service providers.
I will follow up on the question I asked earlier, Mr. Geist. There's no clear definition on electronic service provider. So, do you feel we should tighten that definition? So the electronic service provider definition or main electronic service provider?
And Mr. Fraser, I know, spoke to that, and he could perhaps elaborate around why that very broad definition encapsulates far more than I think most people would realize, given just how broadly it's defined. I did want to return to your question that I didn't have the chance to fully respond to, where you asked why go so broad. And I do think, and I say this with respect, as I look back on the many years of lawful access debate, it is invariably the case that law enforcement seeks as many powers as possible, and one can understand why. They would like to ensure that they can do their job as effectively as possible. But just because you can demand that very broad approach doesn't mean that the government of the day ought to acquiesce, and certainly not Parliament, once it's had the opportunity to study the implications and the trade-offs that exist when that happens. So we saw it, frankly, in Bill C-2, where there was clear overreach with respect to warrantless access to information from anybody providing a service in Canada. People said, hold on a second, that goes too far. And thankfully, the government listened on that issue. But we still have other issues where I think we need to recognize it does go too far, and we need to scale back, recognizing that we'll still address many of law enforcement's concerns and needs.
So, Professor, can you perhaps help us define the definition? And perhaps we just need to be more precise in that.
Well, I think as a starting point, this notion of sort of people engaging with information or information services in that way, as Dave Fraser noted, really does encapsulate everyone. If what we're really talking about is that you've got, and the vision is, and it's difficult because it's just speculating, if it's just core providers are the major telcos, but we're thinking about others that provide what might be viewed as parallel type of services, that's what I would have thought an electronic service provider might be, but that's not what we've got in the definition right now.
Conservative MP Roman Baber also asked about ESPs, and when I ran out of time, Liberal MP Marianne Dandurand allowed me to complete the thought.
Professor Geist, it's very nice to see you in your non-Twitter persona. Professor Geist, I have a major concern specifically with the language of who can be bound by these orders. And specifically, it's the electronic service providers that can be compelled by a minister to come up, design a system, backdoor, etc. And so I look at the definition of service provider. It's Part 2, Section 2, the definitions. It's basically anyone that provides electronic services to persons in Canada and does business in Canada. So then I go and I look to see the definition of electronic service, and it means anyone that involves in creation, recording, storage, processing, transmission, reception, or emission of electronic communication. Well, sounds to me like any law firm would be sending emails or receiving emails through its server, any bank would, any doctor's office would, and yet we hear from the Liberal officials that only internet companies are subjected to this, but that's not what this legislation says.
No, that's consistent with the question that was raised earlier. No, it clearly is not what it says at the moment. It's clearly far broader. If I might, you asked...
I'm sorry, you were just about to get a brilliant thought, Professor, but that brilliant thought will have to go to Madame Dandurand, if she so chooses, for 5 minutes. Thank you.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that brilliant thought.
I think it's way too hyped at this stage. But what I was going to say was, you know, you asked that question with that long list of related to Apple and this notion of, well, what's the problem? As if the problem, of course, is look at all that data that might be ultimately retained and potentially accessed. But there is another problem here. That is the problem that by layering in some of these rules, these companies may well either remove some of the services that protect Canadians. We've seen that with Apple in the UK. Or some may choose to exit the market altogether if they are unable to meet the kinds of standards that they expect of themselves and that their customers expect in terms of the kind of privacy that they provide. So when you layer in a very broad definition of an electronic service provider with very broad demands that may be inconsistent with where the company's at, you create an environment where Canada may well be an outlier and companies either stop providing particular kinds of protections or service altogether.
Toward the end of the hearing, Liberal MP Zuberi asked me a question focused on cybersecurity.
With respect to this collection, and there have been many concerns raised around the unintended uses of this or the unintended capturing by unwanted actors. Do you want to share any concerns around that, about how those who we don't intend to have this information can have it, whether or not it's within the companies in question or hostile actors, be they foreign states, be they hackers, et cetera? Please, if you have something, share.
I'll respond this way. I appeared yesterday before a Senate committee on AI, where much of the focus was on cybersecurity. I have to say, I find it positively dizzying to go from one committee where we're talking about things like Claude Mythos and the desperate need to ensure that we've got as strong cybersecurity as possible to then walk in and talk about legislation that knowingly would undermine that security. Make sense.
And to wrap the appearance, Conservative MP Caputo returned to the issue of metadata and whether 90 days, 30 days, or a year was the appropriate amount of time.
You had mentioned 30 days for metadata would be appropriate. Oftentimes, there's not even an investigator in, like, an internet luring case assigned at 30 days. Bearing that in mind, would you think that, what would you think about 90 days, given those types of crimes, or to address those types of crimes, or the metadata that would allow to address those kinds of crimes?
Well, I guess the best way to respond to this is that too much of the policymaking associated with lawful access has not been evidence-based. It's the occasional anecdote without strong evidence. And so it seems to me if we are in the realm of trying to say, okay, what's the appropriate amount, a year clearly being way too long, what we need is far more evidence, frankly, about when are there instances where that metadata is actually needed, and how long does it usually take before you might be able to get that order?
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at LawBitesPod, or follow Michael Geist at MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.